Well, I'm happy that there is such an interest in a continuation of an introduction. So I will just very briefly review maybe the main point of the last lecture. And so there we had a correspondence between curves in the plane. So our situation that we really sort of discussed was curves in the upper half plane. Maybe a simple curve in the upper half plane. So here's a real line in R2. And then we associated with it a real valued function, Wt. It's a function from the positive reals to the reals. And we wanted to look only at continuous functions. So every curve gave us such a continuous function by means of, we just ran that curve up to a point at time t, gamma of t. Then we took the conformal map of the complement of the curve. So we don't know the future of the curve. We normalized conformal map to the upper half plane. It maps that tip to a point. That point depends on t. That's what we call Wt. And then we discussed the reverse. So if we start with a continuous function, we don't have a curve yet. We start with a continuous function. Then, oh, I should say, so this conformal map called it Gt. And there was that Leuvenet differential equation, the time derivative of Gt of z is equal to 2 over Gt of z minus Wt. So for a point in the upper half plane, well, if it eventually gets caught by that curve, then that equation makes no sense anymore, then we divide by 0. But up to that point, that equation holds. And so conversely, if we started with a real valued continuous function, we solve this differential equation, and we get sort of a dichotomy. So points in the upper half plane, they fall into two categories up to time t. So either they get killed before time t, the killed set that was with the set kt, or they just survive on up to time t. So that's a set, well, the rest, a survival set. And the time t map of that flow provided a conformal map from the set of points that survive up to time t to the upper half plane. So there was really a one-to-one correspondence between these curves and real-valued functions. Except that we also discussed a little bit that these objects, these k sub t's, are not necessarily curves. So first of all, there's a problem for a mathematician. Curve always means continuity. So these guys are not necessarily quite continuous. And secondly, if our original curve sort of hits back on itself, it is never allowed to self to cross sort of transversally, but it is allowed to do such a thing that it bounces off itself. And in that case, so at a time that is after the self-hitting, that compact set would be the curve together with everything that was enclosed. So it would be a real bubble. And so we discussed the area of the set is not continuous. So at that point it catches a whole bubble. So now I would like to continue. I would like to mention first a few properties that have been mentioned very briefly in talks before, but I would like to explain them a little bit more carefully and then explain how to prove some of the at least very basic properties. So the easiest, or I mean one of the most basic and most, but also most important property is the scaling invariance. This one we mentioned already. So if I change time by a factor r squared t, so t is still, if I can fix a number r, and we rescale our Hals in this way. So we just reparametrize time, and we scale by 1 over the square root of this. Then we get the same sets, at least in distribution. So if I run through that process of sets, remember these sets are always increasing. If I run through them with a different speed, then basically I still see the same sets up to some scaling. Exactly. So this is solely, this is not even a probabilistic, so this just follows from a scaling property of a function. So if you have a real valued function and you do that Brownian rescaling, then the Hals for that are the same as the Hals for the original function up to this scaling. Okay. So maybe I should.
What does D again mean?
Say again. Oh, this means in distribution. So you see, if I took, for instance, that square root function, you know, that we discussed, just square root of t. So now we produce the equation gives us a hull, which is, you know, it's a growing line segment, and well,
I didn't understand the question.
That is not.
I mean, I didn't understand Douglas' question. He said there's no probability yet, and I thought you said in distribution.
Yeah. So, there are two answers to it. First of all, there is a probability involved, which sits in the D here, yeah. But. There is also. Well, for me, I'm sorry. I should say, I mean, this is not always. So, of course, I mean, now I switch over. I should have said that to SLE.
Okay.
So in SLE. So now WT is square root of kappa.
That's fine. No problem.
But you're right. I mean, in general, there is. So if I just take one function, and I could think of one Brownian path, then. It generates its hull, and if I rescale, do the Brownian rescaling on that function, even if it doesn't scale nicely, then I get new hulls, which are described by this formula.
And so this rescaling is true for a deterministic function.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or it's true, and it's also true in distribution for Brownian.
Therefore, sort of, yeah. So if I take a deterministic function WT, so. Maybe I should really distinguish. WT stands for just this one individual continuous function. I form a new function, W twiddle T, which is just defined to be the function, the rescale function, WR squared T 1 over R. So now I have a new continuous function. And for one Brownian path, of course, this is a different function. It's not the same function. I mean, it only is the same as we discussed for that family, that square root family. There, the rescaling doesn't do anything. But I get a new function. So I get new hulls, k twiddle t. Here I had my old hulls, k sub t, for the function w2. Here I get new hulls, k twiddle t. And there is a relation between these k twiddles and the k's, which is a very simple relation, which is 1 over r, k r squared t. So the hulls of the new function are really the hulls of the old function, except that I have to evaluate them at a different time and I have to stretch them by that factor. Okay? And that is a very, very simple, really. This is an exercise, a one-line or two-line computation, just with a differential equation. So this is something I encourage you to do. I mean, this follows sort of straight out of replacing this. I mean, just checking, what is the conformal map onto such a thing? That conformal map is going to be the old conformal map, and then with a factor in there, and you plug it into the equation, and you see that that is what's happening. It's a very, very simple exercise. I mean, there is nothing deep behind this. But now if we take one function that is invariant under this, like the function square root of t, then we learn something from it, because then the hulls are invariant under dilation. And so we could see from that the hulls are actually straight lines, I mean rays. If we take a collection of functions, like Brownian motion, a collection with a probability measure, and that collection of functions is invariant under this scaling, then we also learn something from it, because then the collection of hulls that I get with their probabilities are going to be invariant under this this rescaling operation. And that's what happens for SLE. So for SLE, Brownian motion has that property that they're not, of course, point-wise the same function, but they're in distribution. So they get you get the same, you get another version of Brownian motion if you just do that. And so when you stick it into the Leuven equation, you get another set of hulls, and they're the same. So it's another sort of realization of SLE. So that's what we discussed so far, and now I should switch. Yes. So this is now this D stands for distribution, and you can imagine it's a very useful. So if you forget about the time change, so for instance, if you only look at the final set that you get in a domain, so you have your domain or half plane, and SLE provides the curve from here to here, and you're only interested in the total picture, you see, so not in the time, then of course you can even forget about this change in time. So you really look at time infinity basically, and then it says that these sets are really sets are scaling invariant. So the half plane, it really means if I take these curves here and I just double them in size, then I see the same curves. That's a very important, of course, you can imagine, it's a very useful property. And let's see what other processes we could use to get the scaling invariance. And it turns out if we want to have what SLE has, so like the stationary independent increments, what Brownian motion has, and if we want to have a scaling law, it is actually crucial that we have that exponent 2 here. That is sort of precisely that makes it work. So essentially what I want to say, only Brownian motion does that scaling for you. There are other stochastic processes that have stationary independent increments that have some nice scaling with some exponent here, some exponent alpha. They're called alpha stable, symmetric alpha stable processes. But alpha then ranges between 0 and 2, and 2 is exactly Brownian motion. So there is no other process that really does that for you. Say again? No, alpha equals 2 is also the only continuous process. So for alpha less than 2, it's jumping, discontinuous, which isn't so bad. So the pictures, I should have put some slides, but then the pictures look like at every discontinuity you jump a bit, and if time runs, then these jumps can also attach, so you get a branch like tree-like structures. Okay, so that is a very, very basic. That's a property. Once you have Brownian scaling, this is an obvious property. So then the next property I would like to mention is technical, but it is sort of very useful, and unfortunately not so easy to show. So that is about that question that we discussed before about the continuity of the path. So remember, I mentioned that even for continuous driving functions if it's just continuous, even if it's quite continuous, more continuous than Brownian motion is, so if it has a square root singularity, it can still produce halts that look like this, that spiral around infinitely often around some disk, for instance. And at a finite time, you know, this corresponds to that infinite orbit, and then it spirals back out again. And that is something that we don't like very much. So that curve here is not really, really continuous. And basically what I would like to say in SLE, this does not happen. At least with probability 1, you have nice continuous curves. But in order to formulate that, you don't start with a curve, because we start over here with that function WT. So if you start here, how can you get a hold on that curve? Especially because what you observe is not the curve, it's a filled curve, right? You don't observe the curve, you only observe that filled set. So how would you define even that curve here, gamma of t? Well, I mean, the intuition is, of course, there should be that curve. And then you add loops, you fill in these holes. And at time t, there should be that point gamma of t, and that is exactly what gets mapped by the conformal map gt to the point on the real line, the wt. Now, GT inverse is a conformal map from the upper half plane to that complement. So what you would like to do is, continue here. So we would like to take GT inverse at that point W of T. You should be aware that GT inverse lives only in the upper half plane. So typically, for conformal maps, they don't extend to the boundary, to the real line. But here it just turns out you can prove that this makes sense, so that the conformal map does extend to the boundary, and the map T maps to that. So let's call that gamma of T. So it indeed is well defined and is a continuous function with probability 1. So for almost every realization here of these SLE halts, you get a continuous function. And they do generate these halts. So the hull at time t, kt, is really given by that curve together with all these holes filled in. Let's just write holes. And Well, so in other words, SLE, the picture that you get, it really is the way we described it when we started with the curve. There always is a curve. It's sort of a unique curve for the WT. There's a unique curve, gamma of T, that when we, that generates the hull. So the total hull is obtained from that curve together with all these little holes.
What would be an example of a continuous driver term where that
Well, it's exactly this example here, actually. So in this case, gamma of T sort of exists also, but at the special time T naught that corresponds to that, the function gamma of T is not continuous because it's all over the circle at the same time. And you can put this everywhere, so you can make that not only at one time T, but you can have that at every rational time T, you could have such a thing. So it really is dense. So it's full of these little bad spirals. And the function W that goes along with that is actually very, very simple. It is essentially, again, the function like 4 times square root of 1 minus T. So it is at least metrically, it's smoother. It's much nicer than a Brownian motion. The reason that this doesn't happen for Brownian motion is rather that there's so many cancellations. So you have points where the function is worse, but it's sort of, because it wiggles back and forth, it sort of cancels out. All right, I should like to Scott pointed that out just a few days ago. This theorem here, this continuity, maybe I should mention, this is all from joint work with Odette Schramm. This is not known in if we're not in the half plane. So here we really are in the half plane, and we have SLE from 0 to infinity. Now, if we take just any simply connected domain with two boundary points, A and B, then SLE is just a conformal image of SLE in the half plane by the conformal map. So we get a curve from here to here. Now, if you just imagine that this point would be a very, very bad point, one of these we discussed, these sort of infinite snails, then, of course, every curve from A to B has to go through that, so it cannot be continued already at the starting point, so then there is no hope. But even if we assume that the boundary of the domain is nice here, say smooth, and it's nice here, flat, so at least the curve starts out nicely, well, now, if the boundary somewhere else is very bad, has one of these behaviors, there is still a chance that my curve could, if the curve is of the nature that it hits the boundary, it could maybe hit it at such a boundary point and then not be continuous anymore for sort of obvious reasons. So that's an open question. It's actually in a sense related to, it's one of these open questions in Odette Schramm's overview article for the recent ICM proceedings. The question sort of, how large a set can an SLE sort of trace hit the boundary? Because you could understand, there are not too many. There are quite a few points here where the boundary could be bad, but on the conformal pre-image, the set of points corresponding to these guys is a relatively small set of capacity zero. And for instance, for Brownian motion, we would know Brownian motion doesn't hit sets of capacity zero. But this is a different process, so here we don't quite know yet. Anyway, so that's one of these questions that is sort of natural and not so clear. Though Scott said, and I guess he's right, I mean, it could be, if you really had to prove it, and it's, you put in a lot of work, and there is enough machinery should be around to answer that. But then there's another question, which is also very well-known question, very standard. I guess there is a few solutions sort of in the air, but I don't think there's anything quite finished yet. It's not written. Which is called reversibility. So SLE, we should think of it as a process of hulls. You have a domain D, and then you have two points, A and B. So we have a probability measure on, say, curves in a domain from A to B. And now if I fix my domain, but I sort of reverse the orientation, so from A to B, I want to go from B to A, you get now SLE in that same domain D from B to A. Probability measure on curves, and you should ask whether these are the same curves. I mean, now you shouldn't ask. I mean, now you should forget about the time parameterization, because near time zero we have a slit here and we have a slit there, so they don't compare. But the whole G just the image, the whole set. And this is not known. It's known that it is not true when kappa is bigger than 8, but and it's known for a few specific values, like basically those values where we know the discrete model converges to SLE, because for the discrete models it's usually quite quite easy to prove. And I should also mention that this theorem actually was the proof that we had only worked only for kappa different from 8. So for kappa equals 8, the method didn't work. And there it was proved by Lawler, Schramm, and Werner by them proving that the uniform spanning tree converges to SLE 8. And the uniform spanning tree path that is continuous in the limit. So then you can conclude that SLE 8 must be continuous too, because they're the same curves. So that is one of these properties that are sort of technical, probably not super interesting for the physicists, but sort of necessary for the mathematics.
So straightforward argument why it fails for kappa larger than 8?
The reversibility.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's some sort of simple symmetry that you can... reversibility would, in the half plane, just mean that the sort of invariant under the map, the automorphism that interchanges 0 and infinity, so like this one. And then you just look at the probability, for instance, that a point, that the two points get hit in a certain order, like I and one. So it's a simple argument, but I don't see a good intuitive way, but I think there is also no good intuitive physics model that corresponds to that.
Yeah, well, that sort of is consistent with the fact that we don't know any.
Yeah. Anyway, so maybe the more interesting, the more important properties are these phases. So if kappa is between 0 and 4, then that curve really is a simple curve. So that SLE curve is a simple curve in the upper half plane. By that I mean really for different times we get different points. We don't have that self-touching back. So there are no loops to be filled in, no holes to be filled in. It really is the situation, the nice situation that we started. Topologically it's just a line. And when kappa is between 4 and 8, we have a picture where... I should start. Where we do have these self intersections. So the hull in this picture would look more quiet. The hull is just a blob. Maybe it's just a, but the curve is the white thing. Just like in the percolation, exploration path that you have seen. And how could you make this precise? If you wanted to make a rigorous statement of this, you could just say this. Take any point Z in the upper half plane, so fix a point Z, and then with probability 1 the following is going to happen. So with probability 1 the curve is not going to go through this point. Okay, that's the same as it is here. So that basically says that the trace gamma has area 0. With probability 1 the curve doesn't hit this point, but at the same time this point does appear in the hull after a finite time. And so if we really so that point does get killed, and if the trace doesn't go through it and it gets killed anyway, so then the only reason for that to happen is that it sort of got caught by such a loop. So every point, going to fix the point, it's going to be enclosed within finite time with probability 1. And then the last situation is the one for kappa 8 and above. We really have gamma is space filling. So you could say here really for every point the curve goes through it. Within finite time that curve reaches it. It really fills out the whole upper half plane. There is no enclosing, because once the curve encloses the loop it can never go back in, right? Because it sort of has to go outside. So once the whole loop is killed, the curve is that's a forbidden region. So here the SLE oscillates so fast that every point gets hit, no time sort of to form these loops.
What characterizes the different values of kappa for kappa bigger than 8 sort of geometrically, or I mean
for kappa bigger than 8?
Can I see that they're different?
Well, yeah, there's one thing. Let me say, I mean, there's one sort of the next statement, or one of the next ones, is actually about the size of the boundary. Yeah, so you can see the dimension. Ilya mentioned that yesterday. If you just look at the dimension of the trace, this is just 1 plus kappa over 8. And of course, when kappa is 8 or more, it's just a 2. So that doesn't distinguish anymore between the larger kappas, because it's positive area anyway. But now if I look at the outer boundary, this boundary here, I mean, here the outer boundary is the same as the curve, so there is no difference. But here, the outer boundary is really smaller. And here the outer boundary is also smaller. So in that case, the dimension of the boundary of the hull, say, is 1 plus 2 over kappa. So kappa gets replaced by 16 over kappa. So that's that Duplantier duality, which says that that the boundary of the hull should be, in some sense, the same as the hull itself. And so here we have, say, if this is for kappa, then this would be the 16 over kappa, dual kappa. And so here we would have a 2 over kappa. And of course, that only makes sense when kappa is now 4 or more, where we really have a boundary. So this is for kappa bigger than 4. And so what is really proved here rigorously, this is proved. I mean, I would say the method of proof here, in any case, is to control the derivative of that conformal map. Derivative controls size, and so that controls boundary and so on. So in my paper with Odette, we have this upper bound just from having the expectations of the derivative. And then Vincent Befara, he sort of deals with the correlations that also gives the lower bound then. For the boundary, we only have the expectation, so we only have the upper bound. There is no correlations rigorously known yet. So proved, we only have the upper bound, but of course, it's one of these things that is just a question of time when the lower bound gets proved also. But here you see, when kappa gets larger and larger, the outer boundary actually gets smoother and smoother. So what you see here, the SLE wiggles faster and faster, but wiggles so fast that it doesn't even sort of have time to create that. Okay. All right. So then I should mention one more property, maybe, which is useful, which is transience, that SLE path gamma of t really goes off to infinity as time goes to infinity. I mean, one thing is sort of clear, because these hulls, the capacity of that, half-plane capacity, was basically time, or 2 times t. So they have to grow, and it is really made so that only sets of small diameter have small capacity. So the diameter really has to go to infinity. But in theory, this could happen. It's a curve that goes off, and then it comes back down. And then it grows back out and comes back down, and so on. So a curve like that would also have continuous driving term, capacity going to infinity, but it doesn't go off to infinity. So that never happens. It's sort of good to know. So these are the... Well, this is also true, but I mean... Let's just say this, but yeah, it also...
I'm just thinking about the exam time. Could you see that?
Oh, no, wait a second. Yeah, you're right. The imaginary part actually has to, the Lim sup, of course, goes to infinity because it fills out everything. The Lim in, which still stays zero. Yeah, you're right. It is not. It wouldn't be true if we just take the height. Okay. So Now I would like to sort of explain the method of proving at least or how to see that there's a phase transition here at 4, and the other one at 8 is a little bit technically more difficult. And maybe I say just a word in general how to get all these properties that I won't really talk about, the dimension and also dimension of the boundary and how to deal with this case here. And that is what's the following. So if we take, of course analysts like to have a fixed domain, so we should start with a half plane and look at the inverse map, T inverse, let's call this one F. And then we would like to, for instance, let's say we say we're interested in a point Z in the half plane and we ask about the probability that the trace enters a small disk around it. That was discussed before. And in a sense, to control that, it's equivalent to control actually the distance from such a point Z to the curve. So this distance here, this is Z, I want to call this distance D of Z. And that sort of egg-yolk principle for conformal maps, that they actually locally are very nice behaved. Yeah, that gives me it gives me a very simple formula for that distance in terms of the conformal map. So that point Z has a preimage. So we should maybe not start with Z, but we look at the point W over here, and F of W is Z. And then the formula is this, that the distance here, D of Z, or let's write maybe F of W, is up to universal constants between 1 and a fourth or so, is the same as the distance here, which is just the height, the imaginary part, times the derivative, F prime at W. So as you would imagine, you know, derivatives should control sizes, distances, and so on. But we deal with these conformal maps where there is very wiggly object. So there it's not so clear anymore. These maps are not differentiable up to the boundary. But still they do what you would expect they do. So this distance gets multiplied with a derivative to give me this distance, which is a very nice... that's something you would have expected anyway. And so in order to control this distance here, you just need to control this property. And so you're automatically led to study... Yeah, so here you would have the distance from Z to gamma of T, or rather the half A sub T. And of course there's a little difficulty if it gets enclosed. That's a time where you would stop. That all comes with a T, so maybe we should put a little bit of T here.
What is D of W? Is it a distance?
D of W is the distance from W to the real light. So that would just be, we should write the distance in H, and here it's a distance in the complement of the half. It's Euclidean distance. Anyway, this is a detail that I didn't want to go too much into, but it sort of motivates that this quantity now is understood by means of, this is just a number once we fixed our point, it's just the height, the imaginary part, so we need to control this one. The way we control this one is by controlling moments, so maybe you just put an exponent here, take expectations. There is a machinery sort of device for that, probability stochastic calculus that allows control quantities like that. So it reduces the study of such a quantity to a differential equation, second order differential equation in this case here, driven by Brownian motion. No. It really is the Euclidean distance to the closest point, not the tip. So in my picture here, if T is large, the tip would be up here. And still I keep the distance. The D of this is that same distance here, which doesn't change anymore. First maybe it increases and then it stays stable as time goes to infinity.
And in your equation for the peak moment, you have to raise D of W also.
Yeah, but this is just a constant. You're right, but once I fix the point here, I want to know this for the typical point. But you can imagine, I mean, every point here has up to a factor the same law. I mean, it is not that, except when kappa equals zero, then the curve goes up vertically, and then it is different whether I'm, I mean, there is, but for all other kappas, it doesn't really matter whether I'm standing here or here. I mean, the power laws are not affected by the position. The constants in front of the power laws, they will be affected by the precise position. And this is sort of going into the constants, but the exponents in the, I mean, the critical exponent is, it doesn't matter which particular point I pick.
Okay. Using the stochastic calculator, calculate the averages of these powers that get generated.
You can exactly. You can. That is one of the things that the stochastic calculus can just. I mean, can still handle. And so now I would like to show, instead of this one here, an easier one with stochastic calculus. I mean, basically, I would like to show how to use the stochastic calculus to show this phase transition at 4, because it's sort of, you know, that's the first step. That's the easiest one. Okay. And then, okay. So then I would like to, move on to just basically, and I mean, it's not going to be a complete proof, because for a complete proof also of this phase, I mean, we need to prove that it is a curve. And technically, this property is difficult. Essentially, also to control the continuity is, again, you can imagine continuity, the distance between the points is controlled by derivatives. And so in order to do this one, you also need to have good control of these derivatives. Okay, so now let's just look at this case here. So now I want to argue for that when kappa is less than 4, we have a simple curve, and when kappa is bigger than 4, we don't have a simple curve. So what I will prove sort of more precisely is that there is no simple curve in the upper half plane when kappa is bigger than 4. So we have no simple curve in the half plane if kappa is bigger than 4. And how are we going to decide whether a curve is a simple curve that stays in the half plane or not? So the picture is basically this. So here is 0, here is my curve starting out. And if I stop it at a time t, so I get my point gamma of t, and then I have my conformal map g sub t, which maps, and now I should maybe use different colors again. So now I have that right side here, which is, so here is gamma wt, the image of the tip, and then the right side of that slit. Somewhere there is 0, gets mapped over here. And what I would just like to do as a test, I just pick a number x here to a point on the real line, and that would just be sort of pushed even farther to the right. So here is g, t of x. Before I said conformal maps don't extend to the boundary, but if the boundary is really nice, like here we have a piece of, I mean, if it's continuous, then it does continue. The chest problems are at the really bad sort of wiggly parts. So what we see here, if I have a curve that keeps going on and on, there definitely is that space between these points, so that one is not going to be killed. So we have gt of x minus wt. It's going to be always positive if I have a simple curve. And it's an sort of if and only if. So if this curve actually decides to turn around, then at the time where it hits down, this is exactly the time we discussed that before, where this point also gets killed, falls into the singularity. Differential equation ceases to continue. We divide by 0. We divide by this, right? It's 2 over gt of x minus wt. So we can distinguish whether a curve gets sort of eaten up by a loop, or, I mean, the curve runs through it or not, by seeing whether this always stays positive for all times or whether it goes to 0, at which time we have to stop. So here I should say for all time t. So the strategy is to just say, okay, let's look at this quantity, let's look at this size here, and let's see whether this process, so let's give it a name, let's call it x sub t, where this process is actually transient, I mean, right, it's more whether it is recurrent, or does it go down to zero, in which case we know there cannot be a simple curve, or does it maybe not go to zero, in which case it actually will escape to infinity. So, this is the question.
It's even when the curve touches itself, but not rather than touching the real axis.
Yes, you're right. I mean, it could be that we have this situation. But then remember the picture that I drew last time. So if I run the equation for the time corresponding to this here. So first I apply this map, which now, well, this goes now to the tip, and then there's that right part here. And now the curve goes down and hits the right part. So it goes now like this and continues. Okay? So, if we have such a loop, then by running the equation just for a little bit of time, we reduce it to the situation that we're discussing here. And everything is, I mean, it's set up so that sort of the conformal Markov property. Okay, so now we would like to analyze this process, x sub t. And this is what is actually easy for a probabilist. There is probabilists in the audience, so they have to bear with me, and they will be bored to death, but they can do something else. But how do you deal with this? Well, this satisfies a differential equation, so it's very tempting to just take the derivative. So let's look at the derivative, dxt, and I mean, what I'm writing now is, of course, sort of wrong, but so the derivative of this one is nice. But then we have that part here is the that was the square root of kappa dt divided by dt.
So if
the trace hits the axis
why?
At some point, why?
When does this thing change size?
I didn't hear.
When does this xt change size?
At that time, xt, I mean, before it was always positive, right? And at exactly that time, it is going to be zero. But then we stop the equation. You see, now the equation, the equation was this one. We'll write it down in again, but dt gt is 2 over gt minus wt. So at that particular time, we divide by zero, and we don't really know what to do, so we stop the equation ceases to make sense. Okay? That's it. It does not change sign. I mean, you could probably make some sense out of it, but that's when we stop. So that's when we would say that this point got killed by the equation. So that's when it falls into that set k sub t of killed points. Before that time, x was not in the killed set, and at that time it belongs to it. And of course, once it got killed, it's dead. It stays there, so it stays all the kt's for larger times. Okay, so let's discuss this equation here. This is the good thing here is that this is nice. This is just 2 over gt minus wt, which is in terms of x, this is again x. So this would just be 2 over x. But this part is bad. The Brownian motion is, as you probably know, there is not a single, with probability 1, there is not a single time t where this makes sense. I mean, where the Brownian path is differentiable. So this is hard to make sense of. But still, the idea is basically to maybe think of it a bit more formally. I mean, just multiply through with xt. Think of it this way. So it's 2 over xt dt. And then there is a change in that square root of kappa, this is just a constant, so maybe let's move it out, dbt. So the change of the process is first the change in t times that factor, and then the change of the Brownian motion. And so this is what we would like to study. So this is what is called an Itô process. So before I study that, I would like to generalize it a little bit. So more generally, let's look at processes of the form dxt, where is any function here. It doesn't have to be 2 over x, but just some function, which is maybe called something that's called b. So this is usually then called the drift. And then some other function. Here it happens to be a constant, but it doesn't have to be a function sigma. That's usually called the diffusion coefficient times the dbt. So we look at processes like that. So let's say real-valued random motions that satisfy an equation like this. And what is the interpretation of this equation? The way we should like to interpret it is sort of, well, I mean, by integration. So we should really rather integrate this and read it as the left-hand side. When I integrate from a time 0 to t, I just get the change in x. So I get x sub t minus x sub 0. So let's write xt, the minus x0 we put over here. And then we have an integral of b dt. Integral from 0 to, well, now we integrate to t, so maybe we change that to the b ds. And then we have a second part, this part here, integral 0 to t sigma dbt. So the definition, sort of this line here is just, we interpret as an integral. It's just a more suggestive notation. And now you could say, now we are fine, because now everything is sort of easier to define. So this is just an integral. In our case, b is going to be even nice, continuous, and so on. So this is just a regular Riemann integral. And here, sigma is, in our case, here even a constant, but in the application, it's usually at least continuous. So there is no problem with that of any nature. And then you would like to interpret that as a Riemann-Stieltjes integral. So you would like to say, this is the interesting part. Maybe I'll just write it here. So that should just be also a Riemann sum. So we take the interval 0, t, decompose it into small intervals, and then we evaluate the function sigma at an endpoint, let's say tk. And then we take the change of the Brownian motion. So b tk plus 1 minus b tk. So we take such a Riemann sum, Riemann-Stieltjes sum approximation, and take the limit as the the interval 0 t get decomposed as this gets finer and finer past the limit. But here it gets actually interesting, because as you learn in calculus, usually it does not matter where you choose these points inside these intervals, but with these Itô integrals it does matter. So if we chose, not for the constant function, the answer is always going to be, but for a more interesting function, if we took Brownian motion itself here, if this function were bt, then it matters whether we take for an interval tk plus 1 tk, if we take this left endpoint like here, or if we take the right endpoint, the answer of the integral is going to be different. That is sort of an interesting thing. There are two standard ways. In the Itô integral, you always take the left endpoint, and then there's that Stratanovich integral where you take the midpoint. These are the sort of canonical choices. But so there's a technical problem here, but besides that, this is just, that's the way to set this thing up. So now we would like to, so that is an Itô diffusion, or Itô process more generally, and now we would like to analyze it. And how do we find out about the location? So remember, in our case, we had that random particle x, which is distance, and we want to know, is that going to zero or not at some time? And so the way to analyze such a process x is just by applying test functions to it. So now we would like to take a smooth function. So let's say phi. So let phi be a smooth real-valued function, and I would like to evaluate phi at that random point x. And then the theorem is called Itô's formula, is that this process, let's call it maybe Y-chi, so it's again a real value process, that it again is such an Ito process, and so again it can be written in such a way, so the dyt is some function times dt and another function dbt. So let's do this first and then I'll show you what to do with it. Okay, so we would like to estimate this d, maybe I should just write down what it is, so the dyt. And it's such a simple calculation that maybe I should just calculate and then we'll see in the end what comes out, because we don't have to go to too many details here. But I guess the way we set it up, we should just decompose that interval 0, 2t, into these small time steps, tk. So we write that as just the sum over these changes. Maybe let's write the delta yk. So the, well, maybe we should... Right, then delta y. Total change of y from here to here. So sum of these changes of these little y's. And over a small interval now, we... So the change in y, that's just the change in phi. And all that you use basically here is the Taylor formula for phi. So the change in phi is just, well, the derivative of phi at xk times the change in x, and then you have the second order term, phi double prime, change in x squared, and then you have higher order terms. So the technical assumptions here are that phi has, say, for instance, three continuous derivatives, then it's fine. So then that order error term here is of order delta x cubed. All right, so now now basically what you do here is that change in x is, I mean, approximately, if we change that to delta, so it's the b times the change in t. So we have that phi prime. And then we have the b times the change in the t's, and the sigma times the change in the b's. Sigma times the change in the b's. And then we have the 1/2 phi double prime, and then the change in the, so this was the change in the x squared. That's a change in the x, and this change in the x we now have to square. So this thing squared is, well, a b squared delta. Then we have a sigma squared delta bk squared. And then we have the mixed term, the 2b sigma delta t delta b. Plus the higher order terms. Okay, so. And now we just sort of rearrange slightly. So we just form one sum with all the delta t. So we have a sum. And so we see first that b times phi prime times the delta, the delta t's. And then there is that one piece of magic that we will explain a little later, that this delta bk squared, we want to argue that this behaves like, I mean, this is certainly not quite true, but that this is a delta. Delta t. Well, for instance, on the level of expectations, it is true. So that is this is what we want to write for the delta BK squared. So then there's a 1/2 phi double prime sigma squared. And this is times the delta T. And then we have that sum where these... So let's just keep going that way. Then we have that sum with these mixed terms there. So this term here, 1/2 p double prime. Then we have that b squared delta t squared. And then that term with something with a delta t times delta b. And so when you take the... Here I should not have really replaced that delta b squared by a delta t. So maybe we should have left it like this. But now as I take the mesh size to infinity, so as I take... I mean, this is my Riemann sum approximation plus some small error. And now I would like to let this mesh size go to zero. Okay, pass to the limit. And then what I just have to observe is, let's for instance look at this term first. So what I claim is this all goes to zero, or I'm missing one more term, the delta b term, this one here, the phi prime sigma delta b. So what I would like to argue is that when the mesh size goes to zero, that these two terms vanish, and what remains is just this now becomes again an integral. It's integral b phi prime plus 1/2 phi double prime sigma squared bt. And then it is this term here, integral 0 t phi prime sigma. And this is just, I mean, by definition, the d dt. So we would like to argue that these two terms go to zero. And why is that? Well, here it is sort of clear. These guys are, think of n equidistributed points, n points, and the distance is 1 over n. So here we have a 1 over n squared with n points times n. So it's 1 over n, so that goes to zero. It's sort of obvious. What happens here? Well, each increment of the b's, they're independent increments. It's Brownian motion. So these are all independent random variables, small independent variables, and we add them all up. So the expectation of that is obviously zero, and then you just use basically the central limit theorem is enough to show that this goes to zero with probability 1. And in the same way, the only sort of non-rigorous part that I did at this point, I should have written that out. So when I pass from the delta b squared to these delta t's, that is not quite correct. But formally, what you would do here is that the sum of these increments, btk plus 1 minus btk squared, so the delta b squared, that indeed converges to t, probability 1, the sum of the delta t's. And that again is the same sort of very basic probability argument, that these are consecutive increments are independent. So these are independent random variables. Now the expectation is not zero anymore. The expectation of these guys is, well, that's just the variance. So the expectation of this is just the change. The whole sum of small independent variables should behave like the total expectation, which is the sum of the delta k, which is t. And that again can be made formal very easily with a central limit theorem. Therefore, they need the higher moments, sort of the variance of that, which is the b fourth. Then it's very easy. I mean, I don't say that I don't want to do all the details within a few minutes here. It's not that trivial, but it's still very easy, very basic probability. So by the end of the day, then what we got here is it's basically now that we started with this. When we pass to the limit, we get an integral representation for yt of this form here, and that's exactly our definition of Itô diffusion. So that's the drift term of the phi of xt, and that's the diffusion term of the phi of xt. I mean, that was now the change, and so that's yt minus y naught is equal to this integral. So what we have proved here is Ito's formula, I mean, up to some technicalities. So the d phi of xt is equal to, and now, so we have this one, b times phi prime plus 1 half times sigma squared phi double prime dt plus phi prime times sigma times phi dt. Right, so the bottom line is, and this I want to wrap up within a couple of minutes and then maybe have a short break, is the clever choice of the phi is sort of a potential that makes this actually equal to zero. That allows you then to calculate the, basically, I mean, to analyze the behavior of that xt. So now we want to come back to our function xt, which measures this distance, and we want to see whether xt goes to zero or not.
Before you go there, I have some general question. Earlier you mentioned there's a Stepanovich and Ito calculus, which means depending on where I am in the intervals.
Yeah.
But in the end, you didn't talk about any of this here.
So well, you didn't see that, but it is consistent. So if you put it in the middle, then you have to...
It's not what I could just try to do, because he's always
working
the C2 from the beginning to the end. So yeah. That is, I put everything at the beginning or the end of the little interval.
That's what I mean. The last 5 prime times dt, and that's the term. You would start from every single atomic and the form is different, and that's typical paper consistently.
At the beginning of your computation,
you decide
which sense you interpret the product. Yeah. Alright. So now I still have that particle x sub t, I mean the difference, where's this definition? Yeah. And I want to see whether it goes to zero or not. So I guess the easiest way to make that sort of figures is to fix two numbers, A and B. And so to think of X, or X should be in between. So we start out with our point little x, and we want to see under the motion, does it go to zero or not. So I take an interval, A should be basically thought of being zero, and B is close to infinity. But now at least
it's easy to
see that actually that process is going to leave that interval AB. Okay. So we want to stop that process, so we define a stopping time. So it's the first time t when that process x sub t leaves my interval AB. So xt, that random moving point, moves inside that interval, I mean in the positive reals, but let's say inside that interval, and I stop it when it hits one of the two endpoints. And at that time, capital T, then I would like to know, I mean now it is at one of these endpoints, and I would like to know which of the two endpoints is it going to be at. So I say x sub t is, I want to calculate phi of x of t. So we just said phi of x of t satisfies, I mean it's a Ito process, so phi of x of t is just the integral of that plus the integral of that. The integral 0 to t, so the first part b phi prime, 1 half sigma squared phi double prime dt, plus then the second part is the b, or the sigma phi prime, d, b, t. And what I'm doing now is something very simple. Technically, there's a deep, nice theorem behind it, the optional sampling theorem. But now I just take expectations. So if I take average expectation here. Then I observe the following. The expectation of this integral is actually going to be zero. So think of just putting the expectation here. The increments are, have expectation zero. So the average of this thing here is zero. So it totally drops out of the equation. And now if I choose phi in a clever way so that this thing here is equal to zero, then that term is also gone. And I forgot one thing. The whole thing is not zero. So what I forgot is, of course, the term phi of x at zero. Right? So phi of xt is equal to this integral plus that plus the value at zero. But the x at zero is my initial point, little x. Right? So here I could have written little x. So if I choose so if b times phi prime plus 1/2 times sigma squared times phi double prime is zero, then I get that the expectation at the stopping, at the stop time, and what is that expectation? The point is at A or at B. It's the probability that I leave it at A times phi of A plus the probability that I leave at B times phi of B. And this is equal to 0 plus 0 plus phi of x. And now I'm basically almost done with what I want to do. So now what I say is, okay, so if I care for the probability of leaving through A, this is the opposite probability. So this is 1 minus leaving through A. And then I solve for P of xt equals A, and I get that this is equal to so it's phi of x minus phi of b. You just solve a very simple linear equation here over phi of a minus phi of b for, well, a non-trivial solution to this equation here.
Sorry, how do I get the probabilities in? First, to our expectation.
This expectation is I'm at the time t where my particle has just left the interval, or is just leaving the interval. So I move here's at interval AB. My particle starts at x, it moves around, and I stop it when I hit. So at that time, it's either at A or at B. So that expectation is just, it's just these two cases. So it's a probability that it leaves at A times the value of the function at A, plus the probability that it leaves at B times the value of the function at B. It's a function that takes only two values, and the expectation of a two-valued function is just... All right, so now all I need to do is to solve that equation here. And of course, there is a constant functions, which we don't care about. And then the other solution is just a power. So this one has a solution, phi of x, which is... There's a case, kappa equals 4 is a special... There we just have the... Oh, okay. So now I should first say what, now maybe back to our case. So here, my coefficients were b was just that 2 over x. This is b, and sigma is, that negative sign actually doesn't matter, it's a constant. So here our equation becomes 2 over x, b prime, and then plus 1/2 times, this is squared kappa squared, which is a kappa, times phi double prime, equals zero. And the solutions are just p of x. When kappa equals 4, then we have the semi, so then it's just a logarithm. And when kappa is different from 4, then it's just a power, like x, but the sign index, when it's kappa minus 4 over 4, so but let's see. Which one? It's kappa minus 4 over kappa. Kappa is not 4. And now we just see what happens. So now we have solved exactly we found the probability that my particle leaves to through A or through B, I mean in this case through A. And now I would like to let A go to zero. So what is the chance that that particle actually goes all the way down to zero? So now I take the limit that A goes to zero of that probability that I leave through A. And let's look at the case when kappa is bigger than 4. When kappa is bigger than 4, the exponent is positive. So I have I would like to get is actually we want it to go to 1, so why does it
anyone take beta infinities or no?
Yeah, that shouldn't even be necessary, I guess, but oh yeah. Let's see. Have I written down something wrong here? It just doesn't look, it looks a bit funny.
No, I mean, if B is not infinite, you still have a non-zero probability.
Yeah, that is true. But we would like, oh, let's say, so if we just care that this does not happen, I mean, that this has probability zero as A goes to zero. What then has to happen is, that this would just go to... Exactly. Yeah, you're right. So this is so. Thanks. So phi of A. What is phi of A? So when now we plug in. So phi of A when kappa is bigger than 4. So this is A to the. Oh, I guess I should take a let's say kappa less than 4. In that case, I have a negative exponent. So then phi of A goes to infinity. So here I have, this goes to infinity, so the whole thing goes to zero. Does go to zero. It goes to zero if kappa is less than 4, as it should. And it goes to something positive, depending on B, as you said. Something positive. It has positive probability to be killed if kappa is bigger than 4. And so, if we then let B go to infinity, then also this goes to, actually it goes to 1. And so we see basically that...
But you were trying to prove that there was no simple curve if kappa was bigger than 4.
Yeah, so for kappa bigger than 4, we have with probability 1, first with positive probability, but then you can use... I mean, let's take the limit as B goes to infinity, then it gives you 1. So we do have not a simple curve. And it strongly hints, of course, that you have simple curves for... Basically, if you knew the continuity, then based on that, you could prove that it is a simple curve for kappa less than 4. Okay? So I guess maybe we should just have a very quick break. And then all I want to do is I want to explain the similar. What is the sort of calculation you have to do to get the next? So that's the sort of easiest calculation. And it is easy if you don't have to develop the Itô calculus every time you use it. And so I just want to show what to do to prove Cauchy's formula, because that is one of the... important. That started in a sense the whole thing that's behind Smirnov's proof and so on, and how Cauchy's formula for SLE comes out sort of easily out of this machinery. 5 minutes. So maybe I'll just continue. And I'd like to explain Cauchy's formula and maybe a generalization to all kappas bigger than 4. And Cauchy's formula was a formula for crossing probabilities of a percolation clusters in a rectangle. But so if we look at it in just any, I mean, conformal invariance, if we could take a rectangle, say, from zero, I mean, we take the upper half plane as our topological model, and then we have 0, 1, infinity is another marked point, and x is 0, 1, x into infinity. 4 points on the boundary, so that's topologically a rectangle. And then we have our, let's see, population exploration path. I would like to understand where does it hit the real line. Well, it hits the real line right away in a dense set of points. But to understand the law better, I just want to understand where does it, say, so I wait until it kills at point 1 till it touches down to the right of 1.
So I choose now kappa bigger than 4?
Yeah, so here, let's just kappa be any value bigger than 4. So that picture, maybe it's a percolation cluster, which is kappa equals 6. And at some point, it just hits down to the right of 1. So let's say, this time we also, we have a stopping time right there. So let's say t be the first time where my curve gamma of t hits the interval from 1 to infinity. So it's the same as saying it's the time at which the point x equals 1 gets killed. And that point, this point where it touches down, this one I want to call capital X sub t. So xt should just be...
Is it x of capital T?
Yeah. Exactly, capital T. And now I would like to understand the law. Where is that? So it's a random point on the interval from 1 to infinity. Where does it sit? And Cardy's formula says... Well, we understand that point by talking about its distribution function. So take a point x on the real line and you ask for a probability that x is, I mean, it's either to the left or to the right, or right there. It's continuously distributed, so probability that it hits right here is 0. So in this case, x would be bigger than x before it was smaller than x. And this probability is given by some hypergeometric integral. So here I have x less than x. Let's see. So there is a factor in front, which is just normalizing, so that integral is actually enough total mass. 1, it's gamma of 4 over kappa, it's gamma of 8 minus kappa over kappa, and gamma of kappa minus 4 over kappa. And then it is the integral from 0 to x minus 1 over x dt over t to the 2 minus 8 over kappa times 1 minus t over to the 4 over kappa. What it really is, and this is how it is obtained, this function here as a function of x is just a solution to a certain differential equation. So we'll go this very same way. We'll write down a Ito diffusion, and there's going to be associated a generator with it, this one, and then we'll solve the equation, this equation. This is a solution to it, and then you just have to match the boundary conditions, basically.
What is the role of the point 1?
Well, any point would work. It's scaling invariant, so if you take a point 1/2 and you ask when do you hit for the first time to the right of 1/2, you get a picture, and if you scale the whole picture, well, but then this would change. I mean, then you just have to translate this integral. The 1 appears sort of up here, a couple of other places.
That probability should be x lesser than x and bigger than 1?
Yeah, x is certainly a greater than 1. Yeah, I mean, let's...
A big capital X.
So this is for a little x between 1, well, and certainly infinity. So what is the probability that I touch down in the interval from 1 to x?
Okay. And let 1 go to 0.
Well, as I yeah, we have zero. So now let's take your epsilon. And you ask for the probability. I mean, as I said, I mean, when do you want to stop your path? If you stop it the first time when it hits real line, then you have to stop right away. And, I mean, it hits at a dense set of times. So the first time it hits to the right of epsilon happens at some time. Okay? And at that time, if I look at this picture, now I can just scale this picture. So I just scale by the factor 1 over epsilon. Okay? That fixes 0 infinity. Epsilon now becomes 1. That intersection point is just, I mean, the width here is just 1 over epsilon. Width here. And the scale invariance we discussed before means that the picture we see, if we just rescale that very picture here, they have the same, I mean, it's the same picture, same probability, same distribution. So the probability has not changed from here to here. So the probability that I hit down in this integral is exactly the same as the probability that I touched down in this interval. So the strategy, the way to prove this, is basically the same as we had before. But before it was very easy to cook up that interesting diffusion. We just took the GT minus the Brownian term, so that was a sort of obvious thing to do. So now I would also like to associate a sort of a function with it that takes on only two values, depending on whether I touched on here or here. Okay, that quantity xt itself, I mean, I want to study where does this one I would like just to say that this one here is either in this interval or in that one. So I would like to find a quantity that takes on only two values according to whether I'm here or here. Okay, and the way I do that is first I'll just draw, maybe I'll just draw a picture of this situation. Here's 1, here's x, and here's my curve, so I forget about the few wiggles here. And so, if I apply that conformal map that the Loebner equation provides, so that map g sub t, what do I see? So the tip here again goes to the point w sub t. And everything on the right-hand side of that curve up to 1 goes to something. So as I come from infinity, so first I go to this point and I traverse around. I come to the tip, now I'm here. Then I go back on the other side. So now I go doing some blue stuff here until I hit to the image of this one, which is the image under GT of 1. And then it is still some ways to go until I go to the GT of X. And the complement of that slit just gets mapped to the upper half again here. Alright, and now what I would like to do, I would like to renormalize this picture so that eventually I would like to say, I mean, distinguish between the case that this one touches down here to the left of little x, or that it goes over and touches down to the right of x. And what I will do, I just, in order to analyze it, but I will just rescale so that this interval here actually gets size 1. So what I want to do, I want to rescale the upper half plane here just linearly so that the wt becomes, let's say, negative 1, the gt of 1 becomes 0, and the gt of x goes somewhere. So that's the process that I should call maybe y sub t, the interesting one. So what is the scaling from here to here? So I just have to, well, maybe we'll just write down the total map here, ht. Well, I'm only interested in that point, x anyway. So first, maybe it's best to think of zero and 1 here. So we want WT to go to 1. So we should take the GT minus WT. And when I plug in the point GT of 1, then I would like to get, say, 1 here. So I take GTX minus GT of 1. And then I subtract 1. So maybe think of it this way. I want to construct the conformal map or the complement of that slit to the upper half plane. So maybe I should put a Z in here for now. And that's exactly, I mean, this one maps conformally to the half plane. And now I translate, it's still the half plane. I dilate, it's still the half plane. I translate again, it's still the half plane. So it's a conformal map to the half plane. And it does exactly what I want, right? The tip goes to GT of the tip is WT, so that's a 0 minus 1, so the tip really goes to negative 1. And while the point 1 just goes to... Oh, what did I do? I wanted this one really to go to 0, so I should replace this one with GT of 1. Again, I mean, it's again mapped to the upper half plane. It again has that.
What is GTX?
Oh, no, I'm doing something. Exactly. So this is what I want to have. Right? Thanks. Oh, now then without the negative 1. Yeah.
WT upstairs.
All right, so now let's see that this one is, okay, so at least at the tip here. So this one is really WT minus GT. So it's the same as that one with a negative sign. So that is a the tip goes to negative 1, and the point 1 now goes to, 1 minus 1. It does go to 0. And we would like to see what happens to the point X in this picture. So we would like to plug in X, so we call... this point y sub t here is just gt of x minus gt of 1 over gt of 1 minus wt. And now I would like to argue that this quantity is well suited to detect whether we hit down to the left of x or to the right of x. So I would like to say that this quantity here actually goes to infinity if the touchdown is to the left of x. So if that point that I call x sub t, I guess, x sub t is less than x, and it goes to 0 if x sub t... No. If the touchdown is to the right of... No. It was correct like this. And if it touches down to the right of x. So in this picture here, I would like to argue, touchdown to the left of x, that this point goes off to infinity. And how do we see this? Well, essentially... maybe we should think of the sort of capacitor that we have between this part here, the inside, the blue stuff, and the red stuff, or sort of the crossing probability to go from here, from the red, to the blue, but within the domain, within the slit plane. And we will have to pass through that teeny tiny gap just before the time that it touches down. There's a teeny tiny gap that we have to traverse, and then we have to go through. After that conformal map, the point to the right of x is, over here, and then it goes over here. And the blue is just it's over here. The blue is gone, but so let's take a purple. And you see here the hitting probability, I mean the crossing probability from here to here goes to zero as the gate narrows down. And so the crossing probability to here, from here to here, well, in order to go to zero, this thing has to disappear. That stayed within a bounded distance, then there would still be positive probability to cross from here to here. If you don't like this crossing, I mean, there are many conformal invariants. That's where the complex analysis sort of becomes then useful. I mean, maybe another way to think of it is with hitting probability of Brownian motion, then it becomes more intuitive. So if we had this picture, so let's suppose we would like to argue this interval and this one. But this one has to be really large. So I guess what I would like to say, I would like to cook up some sort of harmonic measure estimate. If this point were not very far out, if this were, say, like around one or so, then we would have a point up here, so that if I start a Brownian motion here, it hits down with a decent probability down here. Right? I mean, if this isn't far up, so we have a decent hitting probability for this one, and we have a decent hitting probability for Brownian motion to hit this one. So where would that point be in that slit half plane up here? Well, you know, if it were to the sort of to the right of the gate, sure, here we would have a decent hitting probability to see the red, but we wouldn't really make it to the blue with a large probability because we are cut off by that. And similarly, if we are on that side, we see the blue, but we don't see the red. And right in the middle, we actually see, well, at best we see the blue, but we still don't see any of the red because we're captured by the slit. There are various different conformal invariants, and any of them can detect this phenomenon. I guess you pick the one that you like best. Does it make sense? But in the same way, the same argument also gives now, so we argued for that one, and the same over here. So that curve touches down, you know, if x were all the way over here. Now the crossing from red to blue would be, would be very, very likely. So this point would go very, very close. The limit they would touch. So that quantity would go to zero. So now we are in the situation, sort of as before, that our interesting event, the probability that we touched onto the right or to the left of x, is associated with just two values, infinity and zero, at the and so now we do exactly what we did before. So we had that gt of x and gt of 1, they both satisfy that the equation, the Leuvenet equation, dt gt of x is 2 over gt x minus wt of squared kappa ddt. And the same with the gt of 1. And now we have this inside a function, which is just the fraction. So here our function phi would be a function of two variables, the function, numerator divided by denominator. And we stick in these diffusions. And then we do that Itô's formula, which works for more than one variable. So you basically take the Taylor expansion, so you compute. So what is the dyt? And this is a computation. I mean, that takes, and you need to simplify a little bit. And actually, you have to do one thing that I won't explain, a time change. But so after a simple calculation, you come up with an expression like this. It's 1 minus 4 over kappa divided by, maybe I should indicate that we have a time change by just, well, divided by yt plus 2 over kappa divided by yt plus 1 dt plus dbt. So in a sense, that factor, that drift term that would come out here by Itô's formula you stick into that term by means of time change. So basically, you take the square of this, and that's already what it is. And then you're basically done. So then, now you would like to know the probability that this one either goes to zero or to infinity. Zero corresponds to this probability here. No, that's the infinity. And so then you get that the probability x less than x, so our first touchdown point is to the left of x, it's the same as the probability that y goes to infinity. And this is now the solution to, so you have to do exactly what we have to had before. So drift plus diffusion give you that operator as before up here. So if we call this one B, well, let's just write down the equation, it doesn't matter. So we have this term to 1 minus 4 over kappa. Now this is just the generator associated with it. So here we have this number over x, and then 2 over kappa divided by x plus 1. Times that phi prime. So that's the b, and then times the phi prime. And then plus, the other term is 1 half, times the sigma squared, which isn't there, and then the y, the phi double prime. So we would like to solve that this is equal to zero, and the boundary conditions just the same. Basically, I mean, it's sort of incorporated. If we had already that this is 0 and this is 1, so if this were 0 and this were 1, if that's incorporated in my solution, then phi is really equal to the probability. So the boundary conditions here that I want to have is at the one point when x equals 1, let's call it phi of 1 equals 0 and phi of infinity equals 1.
Zero.
Oh, here it is translated. Here it is zero. Yeah.
Zero.
And that's a hypergeometric. That's a hypergeometric differential equation. And so the solution is a hypergeometric function that you can write down as such an integral. And this is just what it is. This is just a solution to that equation. And that's how you compute these things. All right, so maybe I should like to conclude with one sort of historical remark that was very important. I mean, Cauchy's formula originally was that kappa equals 6, the percolation. So here you have very specific numbers. And then the formula still looks very complicated, but what was actually very an important, though sort of easy step in the development from the complex analysis point of view was Leonard Carlson's observation that this formula for kappa equals 6 gets very, very simple if you choose the appropriate geometry. So if you change the geometry from the half plane to an equilateral. And so, I mean, half plane is topologically the same as a triangle if you make it an equilateral, and the points are, say, this picture 0, 1, and infinity. So let's say this one corresponds to 0, this one to 1, and this one to infinity. And now we look for such a percolation. Now we look at the first hitting between 1 and infinity. So between 1 and infinity is up here. And we look at the first time we get here. So we start down here, and at some point we hit up here. That is the same. I mean, that this point corresponds by conformal invariance to the first hitting down over here. And Carlson's observation was that Hardy's formula actually is, there is the Schwarz-Christoffel integrals describing conformal maps, but this one describes exactly the conformal map from the half plane to the triangle. So after the transformation, the point x here becomes actually a uniformly distributed point. So that point up here is, here the formula, the distribution is sort of the trivial, it's a uniform point. And that then allowed stars also to, that way you can sort of, it gives you some hope. So he cooked up that harmonic function, which is a very simple harmonic function, basically just the height in the triangle, which then gives rise to some an observable.
It's not quite right, because you showed it hitting between 0 and 1, and it doesn't hit.
Say again?
You showed it hitting between 0 and 1.
In that picture here?
Yeah.
Well, this is 0. This is 1, this is infinity, and I bounce around until for the first time I hit between 1 and infinity.
Well, it shouldn't hit between 0 and
1. But it's collision. No. You want to, in the picture at the top.
Oh, this.
You wanted to ask for the.
No, no, these first points, I mean, it does hit. It does.
So it is hitting, it's just that you want.
Oh, I don't. There's no conditioning in here. I just let it run. I just.
Yeah.
It will hit both sides.
Yeah.
Right away.
Sure.
Right? And I let it run until for the first time it hits this
so
side.
It's the first time that it hits between 1 and...
Between 1 and infinity, yeah.
So the point is that it doesn't hit between 1 and x.
Yeah, so this point here, maybe I should have a capital X for the first hitting point. And then I have a little x that I just used to describe, it describes the distribution. So this first hitting point is, its law is the uniform law. Okay, I think that's enough. There are many, many more complicated. This is still a relatively, there are more complicated properties of SLU that you can sort of compute. They all use stochastic calculus in one form or another. So I gave sort of the, I guess a bit easier. This one is obviously more involved in that. But other properties like the restriction property for SLE 8/3 or so, that also uses computation, which is just more involved.
Is there any intuition one can gain why the probability distribution is uniform in a triangle, why the triangle is so good there?
Well, first of all, of course, it's a very special. It's an equilateral, and mathematically, of course, this is only proved really on that hexagonal grid. It's still on the rectangle on the Z2. This is from mathematical, still open. And let's see. Yeah, but that's not so very intuitive, is it? He asked for it. John is the probably the person to answer that question. John, do you have any?
I was thinking about what Pierre said. What was the question?
Well, the intuitive, an intuitive argument why this is uniform.
Oh, no.
I couldn't have expected that without doing the particular transformation.
Well,
conformal
it's just that Smirnov-Scrutz tells you that it's the bounded value of the harmonic function.
But that's the proof, came sort of after the observation, in a sense, right? I'm not sure if stars would have.
One should point out that there are other values of kappa if you choose the angles of the triangle in
yeah.
the right way, then it's also uniform.
I see.
You just have to think about that as a Schwarz-Christoffel mapping, so the angles are related to the kappa.
These angles, I think, if you just take any triangle. There's one angle hidden at infinity that you don't see, which is the opposite angle. And then these exponents here are just the opposite angle. Right? So you take two of those. I guess this is the one exponent and that is the other exponent. After you divide it by pi. So when kappa equals 4, let's 6, then we have a 2/3 here. Yeah, we have a 2/3, so that's exactly 1/3 for 1/3 pi for.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about Smirnov's proof is that, well, no, there are many things, but one is that if you do this on a triangle with a finite grid, where you can do the computation, then it's not linear, exactly linear. So it's only true as the mesh size gets zero.
Yeah, exactly. So that is Starr's proof is
real.
That is not.
So it's not just a combinatorial argument.
No. That's.
Yeah, you're right.
It's maybe a good point to. So what Starr's proof really is, at least a good part of it, is that. Let's see. So he looks at the probability. So now you take your triangle, say equilateral or any other topological triangle. He looks, but let's say the equilateral, and then he takes a point z inside that triangle, and he looks at the probability that, in a sense, like this cluster, so that there is a crossing. So at this point, then we don't have boundary conditions, and I think we just look at the probability that there is a crossing from one side to the other, which separates z from the third side. So let's look at the probability of such a crossing. So crossing from one side, from this side to that side, say, which separates z from the opposite side. And maybe I should have drawn it upside down. So let me allow me to draw this one again. So here's my equilateral. Here is height 0. Let's say here is height 1. And so if my point is very, very close to that height, yeah, then of course we sort of see that there is the probability is very little, small, it goes to 0, and the higher up we go, the probability goes to 1. And what Starr's proves is that this probability, but epsilon is now the mesh size, and this is a hexagonal grid, then he proves that this is now a discrete function. I mean, it is on each hexagon, it is... It's piecewise constant. It's not even continuous. Maybe you make it continuous by force, but it certainly has no very good fine properties. But he shows that it converges as epsilon goes to 0 to a certain harmonic function. And that harmonic function has sort of these obvious boundary conditions, that it's 0 down here, that it's 1 up here. And he proves that it has some sort of Neumann boundary conditions, the direction. And from that he infers that this function is actually just a height. And that formula is basically can be reinterpreted as Pincotti's formula. But this is not very intuitive in a sense. It's very, very clever. The proof that this is harmonic, for instance, is the discrete one is not discrete harmonic, but it's close to sort of the error terms disappear in the limit. The principle is just you have that one observable that has some nice properties, and then with that you can work and prove more necessarily. All right, I think it's a good point to stop here.